Alright, evening everybody. It's an absolute pleasure to be having you joining us. Ari Khan, who's joining us from Givat Ze'ev, just outside Yerushalayim. Rabbi Khan is got his smicha from Yeshiva University, from Yeshivat Yitzchak Elchanan, Ritz. We're studying with Rabbi Soloveitchik as well as Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. He graduated from Yeshiva University with a BA in psychology and a master's degree in Talmud. He's currently the director of the Overseas Student Program at Bar Ilan University in Israel, as well as a senior lecturer in Jewish Studies. He's the rabbi of Mishkan Etrog Community in Givat Ze'ev, and he's the author of more than 10 books on Jewish thought. And just as a personal note, I mentioned to Rabbi Khan a little bit earlier that my first day I stepped into yeshiva some 25 plus years ago, Rabbi Khan was giving a parsha shiur, which he did for a significant period of time, might still be doing that over there. And I was taken by it, and he's literally the only rabbi that has I followed consistently since that first day in yeshiva. I don't want to say up until today. That is really, for me personally, it's a big schut, big honor to be hosting Rabbi Khan. And Rabbi, thank you so much for joining us, and I hand over to you.
My pleasure. Thank you. Mo'odim l'simcha. And this is an unusual holiday, unusual Pesach, an unusual time in our lives, and it seems to be one of these things that we're going to be telling over, hopefully one day, our children, grandchildren, and hopefully beyond. So when I was asked to speak, one of the first things that came to mind was I looked at the calendar and I realized right away that today, at least it's still today in where I am in Israel on Sunday. I'm not sure what time it is in the various time zones that you find yourselves, but today on the 18th day of Nisan is the yahrzeit of Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. So the strange title that I have, What Would Rabbi Soloveitchik Say, or What Would Rav Soloveitchik Say, was inspired by a new generation that does not know, as they say, a melech hadash that doesn't know Yosef, but there's a whole generation that no longer knows Yosef. On a very personal level, my father was a student of Rabbi Soloveitchik and attended his classes for some 40 years. Afterwards, my brother, who Rabbi Krebs told me he also studied with, was a very close student of Rabbi Soloveitchik as well, and was involved in publishing a number of his works. I'll throw out the more serious works, the ones which are actually the Talmudic lectures themselves of Rabbi Soloveitchik. And I was also fortunate to be in his shir for 3 years. I was, I'll say not out of bragging, but I guess I'll have to correct it, only partially out of bragging, that I was probably one of, if not the youngest person there when I was there. And he only taught another 2 years or so after I spent my 3 years with him, which means there are not going to be so many more people in the world younger than me who can tell you that they studied with him. And those who studied with him when we were students in the 50s and 60s and 70s, as what happens over time is that there are not as many students as there once were. And we are now in a generation of people who are students of his students or students of his students' students. And every now and then in conversations that take place, certainly within what we can call centrist or modern orthodoxy or religious Zionism, a question comes up, well, what did Rabbi Soloveitchik, or what would Rabbi Soloveitchik say? And for some people, that's a completely irrelevant statement because a man who passed away in 1990 and was not really functional for probably close to 5 years prior to that, what difference may it make what he would say about something today? So, because we're in a new world. And there is some merit to that. On the other hand, I wanted to reintroduce some of us to Rabbi Soloveitchik and to learn something from him as well today, and some things which I think are really quite relevant and quite current. One of the reasons to ask what Rabbi Soloveitchik would say is because one of the things that he did is that he taught us how to think. I'm going to pause here and go back to some real basic biographical issues. He was born into a family of scholars. His father was the oldest son of someone known as Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim was arguably the greatest Talmudic scholar in the world at the time. The Netziv, who was one of the Rosh Yeshiva of Elazhin, was his great-great-great-grandfather. His great-grandfather, the Beit HaLevi, who he was named after, was also Rosh Yeshiva of Elazhin. Rav Chaim Elazhin is an ancestor as well, the primary student of the Vilna Gaon. So coming out of this family, so at least what he had was what we could call zchut avot, but it was much more than that. As a prodigy, well, as a child, he was a prodigy. And there's some famous stories that when he was very young, he had studied with a Malamid who was Chabad Malamid. And for the reason for this was that his father was a rabbi in a city which was predominantly Chabad, a city which was called Chaslovich. He himself was born in a city which is called Prussian. And just as an aside, my grandfather was born in Prussian as well and remembers the rabbi of the city who was his, Rabbi Soloveitchik's other maternal grandfather, and his name was Rabbi Eliyahu Feinstein, who was actually an uncle of Rav Moshe Feinstein. And by the way, not in the way that you would think, because it was two different Feinstein families. But a Feinstein married a Feinstein, which is what produced Rav Moshe. This fellow, Rabbi Eliyahu Feinstein, was a Levi. Rav Moshe was not a Levi, but Rav Moshe and Rabbi Soloveitchik were cousins, and they had a relationship. I was once in Rabbi Soloveitchik's apartment, and I think it was a couple days before Rosh Hashanah, and next to his phone was a list of people that he needed to call to wish them Shana Tova. So the top of the list was, in fact, Rav Moshe Feinstein. So they were colleagues and they were cousins and they had a warm relationship. I also understood that when Rav Moshe passed away, Rabbi Soloveitchik wasn't that well and nobody told him. And a couple of months later, he mentioned to his family and he said, so Rav Moshe passed away. And they said, well, how did you know? He said, it was his turn to call me. He didn't call. And I realized then that he must not be with us. So there was that close of a relationship. When Rabbi Soloveitchik was young, as I mentioned, his father entrusted his education with a local Malamed, who probably, at least according to legend or lore, and he told the story himself, but you know, sometimes when rabbis tell stories, we don't know what to do with them. And he said that when he went to visit his grandfather, Reb Chaim, who tested him, and he apparently didn't know any Mishnah or Gemara, but he knew a great deal of Tanya. And at that point, his grandfather said to his father, you've been entrusted with this son, you need to teach him. So over the next couple of years, he learned with his father, and according to what I found, and I've heard people speak about this, but this is what I found written, that over the next couple of years, he learned Gemara, Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, Baba Batra, Sanhedrin, Shavuot, Makot, Gittin, Kedushin, Nedarim, Nazir, Sotah, Zvachim, Menachem, Me'ilah, Bechorot, Temura, Kalim, Ohalot, Yadayim, Brachot, Peah, Trumot, Maser, Sheni, and Bikurim. He learned all of those Masechtot with his father. And he started himself keeping his own notes and writing his own chidushim and his own explanations. At one point, his father stole one of his notebooks and sent it to Reb Chaim. And Reb Chaim's response to this was, he was overwhelmed at his grandson's, I'm reading, precocious abilities, and predicted that he would be a major source of Torah illumination for the next generation. What I really want to stress with this is that Rav Soloveitchik was already considered to be one of the great minds and one of the great Talmudic scholars as an early teenager. This was not something which occurred very, you know, later on in life. He was the crown prince, as it were. He was Reb Chaim, if I'm not mistaken, his oldest grandson. Reb Chaim predicted greatness for him. Later on, you know, I'm skipping many years now, when he ends up in Boston, they ask him, do you have smicha? Which is like something only Balabatim can actually ask of a person like this. I mean, what do you mean, do you have smicha? This was Rabbi Soloveitchik. So he didn't have smicha. He never asked anybody for smicha. I mean, it was just almost a joke. So he had been in contact with somebody who were Avram Dov Bir Kahana Shapiro from Kovna, known as the Kovna Rav, and or the Dvar Avram, and he asked him for smicha, and he asked him to send a letter. I'll share with you, let's see if I can do this easily, I'll share with you a screenshot of the smicha that he had. If you can see it, it says, he writes, and this is an English translation, the spirit of his illustrious grandfather, leading rabbi of the time, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, rests upon Rabbi Joseph Dov Soloveitchik. Just like his grandfather, he too is a master of the entire range of Talmudic literature. Happy is the country that would be privileged to be the home of this great sage. The sages have ordained him to be the true interpreter of all religious problems, and the halacha shall be like him in accordance with his rulings. Which means what he wrote in his smicha is halacha kimoto b'chol makom. If you also notice what he wrote in his smecha to him, he didn't write, you know, the congregation or the city. He wrote the country that has him. He, the Dvar Avram, understood very simply that if Rabbi Soloveitchik is in America, then his stature or status should be the chief rabbi of America, because there was an absolute absurdity that anybody else can possibly give a religious interpretation if Rabbi Soloveitchik is there. And that was the kind of stature that he had, which means that I know that I'm going to be guilty, and some can accuse me of having this approach of my Rebbe-ism, where whatever your Rebbe is, that you think that he was that great, but this is not me speaking, this is as he's a relatively young man, where one of the greatest poskim of the previous generation, Dvar Avram, says in his smicha, and I can assure you, my smicha doesn't say this. My smicha says yara yara. That's what it's actually a question and answer. Yara yara, right? It says that I've learned the first chelik of Yeridea. That's what my smicha says. And I was tested and I hopefully passed the test. That's what it says. It doesn't say that I'm master of the entire Talmudic literature. That's what it said in Rabbi Soloveitchik's smicha. And his smicha said, again, those words, halacha kimoso b'chol makom. The law is like him in everything that he says. So this is probably one of the most amazing documents which exists from that, from the century, in terms of an appraisal of another rabbi. A number of years later, Rabbi Soloveitchik applied to become the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, and he did not get the job. Rav Kook was an old man at the time, and one of the people running against him was Rav Herzog. Rav Herzog was probably the leading candidate. Rav Kook passes away, and Rav Herzog replaces Rav Kook, and a Rav Amiel is the one who ends up getting the position. And the Rabbi Soloveitchik's own relative, Rav Meir Berlin or Rav Meir Bar Ilan, worked very hard that Rabbi Soloveitchik should not get it, because in the understanding of Rabbi Meir Bar Ilan, he was too Haredi, and he would better off be Rosh Hashiva than become the rabbi of Tel Aviv. But I want to again share with you a letter that his father wrote to the voting council in Tel Aviv about his son. And this is again another amazing document. He writes as follows. In earlier generations, it was felt that Torah and secular studies could not be joined together. However, in this generation, we do occasionally encounter masters of both disciplines. My son is the prime example of this accomplishment. He is the greatest Torah scholar of our times. His Torah knowledge is awe-inspiring on the level of that of rabbinic luminaries of previous eras. Likewise, his mastery of secular studies is the most unique among contemporary Torah scholars. And there's the source of where to find this. So again, I share these two documents because when people say things about him, okay, you know, if people sat in his chair or people respected him and he had a great charisma and so on and so forth, but virtually everything that people say about him is underrating him and is not giving him the proper respect that he actually should have. And I know that that may sound like a very strange statement. I had an interaction with the rabbi, and I won't go into any details. Again, we both were discussing a particular issue, which was actually very current and very important. And I mentioned something that Rabbi Soloveitchik had said about it. And he said, okay, there's lots of other rabbis aren't his level. And I did not pursue the point, but the answer was no. There were not a lot of other rabbis who were on his level. And the Dvar Avram didn't feel that. And certainly his father, you can say his father is pasula edut. He can't really testify about your own child. But nonetheless, the things which are said about him are not, this is not within the norm of the way that people will testify about others. As a young man, the other thing that he did, which was unpredictable, and that is that he went and pursued this secular education that was mentioned by his father, and he ended up getting a PhD in philosophy. And by the time he comes to America, he is this master of multi-disciplines. And I'll just say a little bit about learning with him. So as I said, I was in his chair for 3 years. I also spent a summer with him in Boston. A couple of the students would spend some time with him. That was a much smaller group, 20, maybe 25 people were with him. And when you would speak to him or listen to him, but more speak, you came to this realization that all of Judaism was open to him Everything was worked out, everything was thought about, and everything was processed, and everything was understood on a deep level. It wasn't like suddenly you asked him a question that he never understood, he didn't know what to do with, but he processed it. My father told me a story, which I hope that doesn't contradict everything I just now said, but I want you to appreciate the part of the process that took place. Just because he thought about everything doesn't mean that he felt he had a good solution for everything. It doesn't mean that he felt that everything was perfectly clear. So in today's world, there's difficulty. What do we do in a case of surrogate motherhood? Who's the real mother? The biological mother or the mother who gave birth? It's not a very simple question. Years ago, Rav Moshe Feinstein, one of the most important rulings that he gave was a ruling regarding artificial insemination. And he was attacked for it. He was violently attacked for it. And I say violently, not that he was physically attacked, but violently attacked. There were people who bullied him. People called up the house in the middle of the night. People sent ambulances. People told his wife that he had passed away and so on and so forth. And he was bullied. And the other side was, if a woman, a married woman, is impregnated with the sperm of a different man, then that child is not legitimate. Rabbi Soloveitchik understood the complexity of this, and he did not wish to give a ruling. Now, you can say, how can you do that? But he didn't want to. And he told over in a public lecture, and again, I heard this from my father who was there, that he, again, in a public lecture for him could have had a couple thousand people there. And in a public lecture, he said that somebody asked me about, somebody called me up and said, I've given birth to a child who is artificially inseminated, and now somebody tells me that my child is illegitimate, or the technical term would be my child is a mamzer. Rabbi Soloveitchik, is my child a mamzer? And Rabbi Soloveitchik said, I don't know. And she asked again, but is he a mamzer? And he says, I don't know. And she asked again, is he a mamzer? And Rabbi Soloveitchik said, I don't know. Now, his not knowing is not because he never studied, never considered it. It was just something that he felt was sufficiently complex that he did not wish to give a ruling on, which is also important. He was not known in certain circles as being a posek. And in other circles, he was known to be identified with sometimes polar opposite positions. And the reason for this is that he was very subtle when it came to language. And if somebody were to ask him a question, depending how the question was phrased, they would get a different answer. So if somebody would ask him and say, Rabbi, what should I do in this case, is very different from saying, what does Judaism say about this particular case? So therefore, if somebody asked him what Judaism says, he was very likely to give a different answer than what I should do. Because what I should do, it has to do with the individual. And the other question was more of a philosophical question, what is the range of opinion within Judaism? And he would not always reveal his own personal approach on things. With students, he would more than he would with the public. But it very likely that three people can ask him the same question and walk away with three different answers because they phrased it differently or they were different people. And that created a situation whereby multiple people will quote multiple things from him because, and not because he didn't say the multiple things, although sometimes that did happen. Sometimes people misquoted him and just said, Rabbi Soloveitchik said, because, you know, why not? If they could, why not? He was seen as somebody, you know, I want to go back a second. In his Gemara share for 3 years or 3+ years that I sat in, he never once mentioned a secular philosopher. Maybe that comes as a surprise when you read his writings, but as a Rebbe giving shear, he gave shear. What I can tell you about what he didn't share is he was more likely to quote Rambam than Rashi. He would read the Gemara and then read it together with the Rambam, and then he would try to understand what the nuance or what the Gemara, what the Halacha, what it was made of. One thing which he did in Boston is he opened up a school, which is a co-ed school, and then people said, okay, is co-ed education, therefore, as far as he was concerned, lechatchila b'di'evid, and he gave both answers to different people in different situations, so one will never know what he really did believe. You can say, but he opened the school, but he also said in Boston there was no choice, so I'm not going to resolve that. But what I can tell you what he did while he was in Boston is that he felt he had the responsibility of reaching out to the greater community. And every Saturday night, he would give a shiur. And the shiur was one which was a parsha shiur. And we still have the notes of this, at least I do, and some others do, and a number of these things have been published. And the shiur that he gave was dramatic. and it was a performance. And the reason for this is that he understood his competition, that if he didn't give an exciting shiur, which again could have students coming from MIT or Harvard or other such places, and people teaching in those places as well, then they would be going out to the movies or to the theater or doing something else. And he realized that at least part of what he needs to do is entertainment. And he therefore took teaching Torah to a level of entertainment, of intellectual entertainment, and drama, and the way he would teach was beyond what I think most of us who've never met him could imagine. Again, that's not what his Gemara Shir was like, but when he needed to turn it on, as it were, he could and he would. He was a man, as his daughter said, who could tell his intimate feelings to 3,000 people easier than he can do to somebody who was sitting in front of him. And he had the soul of a poet, and he was able to go to the most innermost, you know, part of his being and be able to articulate and to share this with others. Nonetheless, he spent most of his time teaching Gemara. Most of the shirim that he gave was Gemara. On the other hand, he also gave classes in philosophy for at least a number of the years, not throughout all the years. And he was this wonderful combination, being able to speak in terms of secular literature, understanding, science, and so on and so forth. And he was completely at home with all things. One of the things that I did mention to this person recently was when people were discussing now the Zoom Seder and so on. At the time in America, in the 50s and 60s, they were discussing if one can use a microphone on Shabbat. And there were some rabbis who allowed it, and Rabbi Soloveitchik didn't allow it. And he had said at the time that the ones who allowed it only made two mistakes. One is they didn't know how electricity worked properly, and two, they didn't know the laws of Shabbat properly. He goes, if one knew both of those things, then they would not have come to such a conclusion. And he then did say that he wrote a long discourse on this and was going to publish it. And as far as I know, that discourse was never found and was never published. But I will mention, because again, my brother went through a number of his writings in order to put together his books. My father actually went through hundreds of his recordings in order to catalog them. And I'll just tell over a side of a story that people don't know, and then I want to come back and actually teach some Torah from Rabbi Soloveitchik as well, even though we tend to like stories. One of the things that he did is that he gave a Gemara class in Stern College, which is very famous. The reason it's famous is because it was the first time, as far as we know, that a Gemara class was taught in America to women, certainly by somebody of such stature. And he felt that the women in Stern needed to know Judaism, and Judaism, as far as he was concerned, starts with Torah Shebaal Peh. And if they don't know Judaism, then their own belief will suffer in terms of the larger world and larger community. And when he signed off approving that such a class should be given, he said, let me teach the first class so people then won't say that I wasn't in favor of it, or they misinterpreted me, or they misquoted me, which again happened quite often. So he gave the first class. And around 2 years ago, 3 years ago, somebody wrote an article about it and said that the class was identical to the class that he'd given to men. It was the same kind of class exactly. And I mentioned this to my father. I went to visit him. I remember it was Chol HaMoed Sukkot, and my parents were away, and I went to visit them in their hotel. And I told this to my father, and he started to laugh. I said, what's so funny? So he told me that while he was going through all of the Rabbi Soloveitchik's lectures and cataloging them, he came across one which was completely different from all the other lectures that he had heard. And the Rav was very light, and he was telling stories, and he was entertaining, but he was teaching Gemara. He said it was just so untypical of his Gemara class to be that light. So he had mentioned this to the Lichtensteins, and Tova said, what's the topic? And she went and looked it up. She goes, oh, that was the first shiur that he gave in Stern. And she went and pulled out the manuscript, and he had a longhand manuscript of everything that he taught. I mean, maybe that came as a surprise to some people also, but everything, he had a longhand manuscript, and she looks at the manuscript, and the manuscript had none of the jokes, none of the light, none of the stories, none of this lightness to it. So he actually, the truth is, he prepared the same class as if he would give to men, but when he walked into the room, he probably sensed that he needed to do something else, and then he broke it up full of stories and, again, this other lightness to it. So the shiur actually came off very different from the typical shiur that he gave, but that was the backhand story of the first shiur that he gave in Stern. I'll tell another story about the Rav, when I was there, which was the early 80s, he was giving a shiur, and at some point he stopped it when he was, you know, older, but he was giving a shiur in Parsha on Wednesday nights. He lived in Boston, flew to New York. Those of you who don't know the distances involved, it's half an hour by plane, around 5 hours by car, and he would come in every Monday or Tuesday, and then he would go back on Thursday. And Tuesday nights he used to give a public shiur in Gemara, and then Wednesday nights he started to give this shiur in Parsha. The origin of the shiur was as follows. After his wife passed away, when he was in New York, there were a number of yeshiva students who would be in the apartment. One would get him food, one would help him this, one would answer the door, and then so on. And most of these guys were elderly yeshiva students in their mid-20s, upper 20s. And one day he looks at them and he says, "What are you doing here?" And they said, "Well, we're here to help you." And he says, "Why aren't you married?" And most of these guys were single fellows, which is why they had so much time to be with the Rav. And they said, "Well, it's not easy to find someone to marry." Now, this is, again, modern Orthodoxy in the late 70s, early 80s. And they say, "We don't go on shidduch dates. But on the other hand, we're just not going to go to Stern College and hang out in the lobby till a girl walks out and then hit on her. I mean, that's not very dignified." So he listened to the quandary that on the one hand, this is modern Orthodox. They're Orthodox enough that they're not going to just hang out in some place in a bar and pick up a girl. On the other hand, or the lobby of Stern College. On the other hand, they're not going on shidduch dates. So the Rev said, "I have a solution for you. Publicize that I'm going to give a co-ed Parsha Shir. This will bring all the girls from Stern and from the Upper West Side and from Columbia and Barnard and so on." In those days, it was only Barnard. I'll bring all the girls into the room, but you have to go over and talk to them afterwards. And that's why he started the Parsha Shir, in order to have a situation that men and women could meet in a holy environment. But he felt that that was something which is necessary. This was long before they spoke of what today is known as a quote-unquote shidduch crisis. So going over to try to learn some Torah together, Le'ilui Nishmato, which again I said today is his yurtzeit. When we would learn, part of what he would do was try to break the topic down into its component parts. Now, when I use words like that, I'm actually describing Reb Chaim, and I'm describing his father, Reb Moshe. I'm describing his uncle, the Brisker Rav, Reb Elvel. Just one more story. There was a situation once, there was an argument between Reb Elvel and between the Rav, and they were closer in age, by the way, because Reb Elvel was his father's younger brother. So, there were these arguments took place when the Brisker Rav may have been, again, don't catch me in the exact years, may have been around 19 years old, and the Rav may have been 11 years old or 12 years old, but they would argue in terms of halacha, and they would argue as equals, which is also something which I think in a large part of the yeshiva world today, they would have a very hard time with. If you were to learn the Brisker Rav and you would learn Reb Chaim and you learn Reb Moshe, I know that there are some people, I have some friends and colleagues and people I respect, who'll be able to tell you what the nuance is in terms of the difference of approaches. On the other hand, the similarities are far greater than the differences. And essentially, there was one approach, which was Reb Chaim's approach, where the same questions and the same issues were raised between Reb Chaim, Reb Moshe, Reb Elvel, and the Rav, and the various children and students of all of those people. But if you look at their writings, you'll find the same kind of things. Incidentally, part of where the Rav diverted from the others is not in terms of anything other than the topics that he learned. The Rav, for example, taught brachos for many years, or brachot for many years, and he brought the brisket derech to brachot, which really wasn't there in the writings of the others. And there's all kinds of issues because of this, and he was a master of brachot. And many, many years later, after he had taught this, there was one of the great rabbis of Bnei Brak, if I'm not mistaken, it was Rav Shmuel Rizovsky, Rav Reuven, Rav Shmuel Rizovsky, I think that's who it was, who was sick and had to go to Boston for treatments. And again, he was one of the great rabbis in Bnei Brak. This is at the same time as not Reb Chaim Kanevsky. He was there as well, but his father, the Stipler, and Rav Shach, and others. And the Rav came to visit him. He heard that there was a Talmud Chacham in the hospital from Israel. He came to visit him, and they started talking and learning. And when the Rav walked out, he said to people that are there, he goes, I testify that there's no one in Eretz Yisrael who knows what he knows in terms of halacha, in terms of minhag, in terms of Kabbalah. And he said that he was absolutely overwhelmed by the reality of meeting the Rav. But part of what the Rav did is that even things like brachot were something that was subject to the Bris Kederach, which you don't find in some of the others. When I was in the Rav Shir, as I said, I was there for 3 years. One of the years that I was there, we learned Menachos, or Menachot. And the topic that we learned was actually right now what we're up to is the Omer, not so much Sefirat Omer, which is a part of it, but the Korban Omer. And I'm going to mention something about one of the sugya that we learned, but again, just as an aside, a personal story. During this time, I had just gotten engaged when we were learning Menachot. And my wife's family are very wonderful Jews who were not learned more than my father-in-law going to perhaps a Parsha Shir or a Gemara Shir once a week, but I don't think he had ever formally learned in yeshiva. And they had a friend who had smicha, who decided that he would do a favor for them and that he would test me to see if I was worthy to marry into the family. So he decided he was going to give me the Yiddish is a feher. He was going to give me a feher and test me to see my knowledge. So he was invited. I was there for Shabbos. He was invited for lunch. He walks in and he starts on me right away. He goes, "So what are you learning?" So I said, "Menachos." And that was the end of the conversation. The man who was a Talmud Chacham had never learned Menachos. And so then like he tries, he goes, "The stuff that deals with tzitzis and tefillin." I said, "No, Perek Rabbi Yishmael." And that was the end of the conversation because we had learned Menachos at the time. Now, one of the things that the Mishnah deals with there is the what happens if the day if Pesach would come off on a Shabbos, and therefore you have to bring the Omer as well on in the afternoon, to bring it in the evening, the first day of the Omer, but you bring a Korban Omer. How does this work in terms of Shabbos and in terms of Chol? Is Shabbos is pushed aside, but how is it pushed aside? Which leads us to a question which is called Duchuya or Hutra, which means, is it, and I'll put it like this, is it as if it's not Shabbos right now? Or it's Shabbos, but Shabbos gets pushed aside? This question becomes a question which is one which the Briskers could use in all areas of Gemara learning. And I'm not going to go through every single question, but let's say a Kohen, who, God forbid, his relative passes away, so he has to go to the funeral. Is he still a Kohen when he goes to the funeral? Or is his being a Kohen completely forgotten? And I know that it wasn't clear, but maybe I'm going to come back to it and try to make it clearer. One of the things we're told is we can't wear shatnis. We can't wear wool and lin together. Tzitzis, when you put them on properly and you dye them with the blue, you will end up having wool and linen. If again, you the proper beged garment to wear is wool, and if you then dye the strings properly, you're going to have linen, so you have wool and linen together. So therefore, what happens? Is it that it's gently pushed aside, which is called dechuya, or is it hutra? It's no longer, there's no prohibition of shatnez anymore, there's no kalayim anymore. What would be, quote-unquote, a nafgamina, a difference between the two approaches? Can I wear tzitzis at night? There's no mitzvah to wear tzitzis at night. So therefore, does the prohibition of shatnez override tzitzis when there's no mitzvah of tzitzis, or for that matter, a kohen? A Kohen who wears big day kahuna, he wears clothing of a Kohen, also has wool and linen together. So therefore, when he does the service, he's able to wear. What happens when the second the service is over? Does he have to take it off? Does he have to take it off before he leaves the Beis HaMikdash? Is he allowed to put it on at home before he gets to the Beis HaMikdash? Which means the idea of wool and linen, is it dechuya or is it hutra? How does this work? And this is a question, I'll say it again, comes up in all kinds of situations. One particular case that I want to deal with, which again, I sense it as being more important in terms of where we are today, and that's the question of Pikuach Nefesh. Now, one of the hats that I wear is that there is an organization in Israel which is called Zaka, which does a lot of work in terms of saving lives, and sometimes even after there's no longer a life to be saved. And I'm one of the rabbis that they ask questions to. So issues of Pikuach Nefesh, I get asked very, very often. I got a call from one of the heads of Zaka as recently as 45 minutes ago, right before I started. I got a phone call from one in terms of a question that had to do with Pesach. So when it comes to the situation of what we call a pikuach nefesh. If somebody's in a life and death situation, are you able to break Shabbat? And of course, all of us know the answer is absolutely yes. So let's take a look again at a source and see what it says in the Shulchan Aruch. The Mechaber writes, "Kishimechalulin Shabbat al choli sheyesh bo sakana." When you, as it were, break Shabbat, or mechalel, break Shabbat, in order to save somebody, a sick person in danger, mishtadlin shelo lasot ayidei akum, uktanim, v'nashim, elayidei Yisrael gedolim v'nedat. The proper way of doing it is not by asking a non-Jew or somebody who's a kid or women and so on. Rather, you would ask the gedolim v'nedat. There's a question, is Yisrael, what the word gedolim means? Okay, but certainly means somebody who's not a katan. You don't do it in a, shall we say, in a way, let's leave the non-Jew for a moment. Non-Jew doesn't have to keep Shabbat, so non-Jew should be the best solution. Actually, the Rama writes, Haggah, v'yesh amrim, de'im efshar lasot below dichui, below ichur, al yedei shinoi. If you could do it, you know, without a delay, by doing it in a stranger way, so maybe you're not breaking Shabbat. Osei de shinoi ve'mefsher lasot de akom below ichor klal, and if you non-Jew can do it, it's better. Osei de akom v'chei nogin av mokum tirish lechushi tatzel akom in lasot de akom. So what is it that the Mechaber and the Rama just now said? That if there's a situation of pikuach nefesh, it's which means a Jewish life is in danger on Shabbat, you break Shabbat. How do you break Shabbat? So the Rama says break Shabbat in the most minor way that you can, which means do it, you know, if you could put a light on, if that were the case, with your elbow, you do it with your elbow, you don't do it with your hand. If you have to call an ambulance, you know, do it by pushing the buttons with your nose and don't do it with, and so on and so forth, with the shinoi. That's what the Rama said. Some of the Mechaber said. The Mechaber said you don't ask the non-Jew to do it. You don't ask a kid to do it. He goes, rather, somebody who's an adult is to do it. He said, Yisrael, you know, who's a gadol, who's an adult. The Rambam is even more forceful, and let's take a look at how the Rambam articulates this. The Rambam starts off by saying, "D'chuyehi Shabbat etzel sakana nefashot," that when it comes to a life in danger, Shabbat is d'chuy. Now, d'chuy generally means lightly pushed aside, which sounds right away as if the Rambam is siding with the Rama, or actually the other way around, the Rama is siding with the Rambam. Kishar kol mitzvot, laficha chol sheyesh bo sakana, osna kol tzarchav b'shabbat, al pi rofei uman. If a doctor says he needs something, a doctor who's skilled, then you push away the laws, shalot ha-makom, you know, that particular time. Safik shu tzarich lechelel v'te shabbat, safik she'eno tzarich. If we don't know, and we think maybe he needs it, v'chein im rofei lechelel alav v'shabbat, rofei acher omar eino tzarich, mechalim alav v'te shabbat, shesafik nefashot adochei at shabbat. So the first thing that we're learning from the Rambam is he uses the phrase dechui, which actually means it's pushed aside, but it's not as if it's not Shabbat. Again, the two different approaches are like this. If it's dechui, it means that the prohibition of breaking Shabbat is still there. That sounded very much like the Rama, so therefore do it with your elbow, because you don't want to really break Shabbat. Ask a non-Jew to do it, and that's the language the Rambam uses. On the other hand, the Rambam is going to tell us the exact opposite in the next paragraph. He writes in bed, I'm going to skip a little bit. He says, you're able to light a candle, and you're able to put out the fire if you need. You can cook and so on. It's as if it's not Shabbat. Now, if it's not Shabbat, then why is the Ram saying that you should do it? So then why did he use the word dichui? That's the wrong language he should have used. And the Rambam knows language as well as we do. And then in Halacha Gimel, the Rambam writes, Ukisha osim dvarim elu, eino sinotam lo yadei nachrim. You don't ask a non-Jew. V'lo yadei ketanim, v'lo yadei avadim, v'lo yadei nashim, kidei shelo tehei Shabbat kala be'ineihim. I know that the inclusion of women here will bother some of you, but the Rambam lived in a time where women were not educated. So therefore, he says that if you'll ask somebody who is seen to be as not knowledgeable in the laws of Shabbat to break Shabbat, then Shabbat will not be valued in their eyes. Ela ayidei gedolei Yisrael v'chachmehem. Who's the one who should break Shabbat? The rabbi should break Shabbat. You shouldn't, you know, tarry for a moment. The laws of Torah are not vengeance, ela rachamim v'chesed v'shalom ba'olam. V'ilu apikorsim she'omim she'zeh chilu shabbat v'asur aleyim, ha'katev omer gamani natate lechem chukim lo tovim u'mashavtim lo yichyu bahem. So what the Rambam is saying over here, and this is where there seems to be a sensitivity and a potential situation where he was soter himself, where he said the opposite, contradicted himself, he uses the term dachui. Dachui means gently pushed away. Dachui would have led me to believe that I do it with my elbow, that I do it asking a non-Jew. But then he says afterwards, no, a Jew has to do it. So Reb Chaim explained that, and by the way, when there was a cholera epidemic in Brisk, Reb Chaim himself went to help the people that were sick. He went to volunteer in the hospital. He went to deal with the people that were sick. And he said, why? Because b'koach nefesh is something which the, not just on Shabbat, it's something which the greatest people have to do and be involved with, and Reb Chaim himself. And that's where the famous statement of Reb Chaim, that he's machmir on b'koach nefesh and not mekel on the laws of Shabbat. Rabbi Soloveitchik himself told the story multiple times in multiple ways, that when he was young, he was sick and he was visiting Brisk. He was in by Reb Chaim. He was, again, I don't know exactly how old, but he was quite young. And he had a fever. And they called the doctor, and the doctor came in, and Reb Chaim said to him, do you need a light lit in the room in order to be able to do a proper examination? And the doctor said, no, I could do it without. Reb Chaim then said, would a fire help you? And he said, yes. So then he turned to his son. That's one version of the story. The other version was he turned to the dayan of Brisk, Reb Simcha Zelig Rieger, and he asked either him or him to put on the light. And according to the way the Rav told it, one time his son hesitated, Rav Moshe hesitated because the doctor said, I don't need it. And Rav Chaim said, you know, what are you, an Amaretz or an Apikoris? You don't know the Rambam. He goes, the Chachamim should do it. And again, he's saying, I consider you to be the Chacham. You're the one who needs to do this. But the doctor said it will help. And Rav Chaim, again, his famous statement, it's not that I'm lenient in terms of the laws of Shabbat, I'm machmir in terms of the laws of Pikuach Nefesh. And, you know, which just to wrap things up a little bit, because I'm getting towards the end, I was one of the first rabbis, certainly in the city that I live, but one of the first ones in Israel, that shut the shul when it came to this coronavirus. And, of course, there were people who, no one said it, but I'm sure there were people who were disappointed. I don't want to use the word upset, but disappointed. I mean, people saying Kaddish, people, it's important to daven Betzibur. Maybe even there was an innate feeling that it's our davening which is going to help in this situation. But it became a very, very simple thing because I asked myself, and even subconsciously, what would Rabbi Soloveitchik say? I don't even have to go through that process. It's Wermachmer and Pekoach Nefesh. If there was a possibility of somebody getting infected by somebody else because they're in the same area, and a shul is a wonderful way to bring a lot of people together, and it's a wonderful way to infect people, so of course we have to be machmer pekoach nefesh. There's no question. One of Rabbi Soloveitchik's greatest living students, Rav Herschel Schechter, he was the first one who told rabbis in America that they have to shut the shuls and everybody stay at home and absolutely not go to shul. And I'm sure what went through Rav Herschel Schechter's mind is this exact same lesson, is because that, yes, there's an ethic of Shabbat and there's an ethic of Pikuach Nefesh, but Pikuach Nefesh is something you have to be machmir with. And this process is something which has to be ingrained. Now, I just want to, again, try to say this in a little bit of a sharper way. So why did the Rambam just say that it's Hutra? It's not Shabbat. So he says, no, that's exactly the point. That's exactly Reb Chaim's point. That he's machmir pekoach nefesh because it is Shabbat still. Which means if it were Hutra, it's not Shabbat. So then it's nothing to break Shabbat. It's not that I'm machmir pekoach nefesh. It's just not Shabbat in a situation of pekoach nefesh. And Reb Chaim's whole point is, no, it's dechuy according to the Rambam. It is Shabbat. But nonetheless, then why does somebody have to break it? And it goes back to the situation I mentioned before in terms of, unfortunately, when a Kohen has to be metame himself when a family member, it's not that it's hutra, it's dechuya, but it's a mitzvah for the Kohen to become tame. Why? Because so important is Kivud Av V'Em. So important is this mitzvah when he has this immediate relative. In terms of Shabbat and Pikuach Nefesh, it is because it's Dechuya, that it's, but it's still Shabbat, and still the Rambam held that the Gadol had to do it. Not just an adult. The Gadol, the Chacham, the Talmud Chacham, the Dayan of Brisk has to do it. The person who is of great significance is the one who has to break Shabbat because we're so machmer and pikuach nefesh. But this is the world of Brisk. It wasn't just a theoretical world. And therefore Reb Chaim had to enter into a cholera epidemic and carry people out on his shoulder because this is the world of Torah. And I don't know if I have to stress this or say this. So therefore Reb Chaim didn't paskin like the Ramah. He didn't really even paskin like the Mechaber. He passed like the Rambam, because this is Torah. This is what he understood. This is the values that he understood. Learning with Rabbi Soloveitchik, every single topic was broken down in this way, to understand the components, to understand the details, to understand how the Lacha worked. And at the end of the day, his paskening was one which was complex, because Torah is complex. On the other hand, I could tell you that he was able to make the most complex things in the world seem simple, seem obvious. And he was so compelling. To sit in his shiur was an absolute privilege and pleasure because everything made sense. Everything was simple. The most complex things in the world, he just showed you the moving parts, and then everything in the world made sense. So when I started with my topics, what would Rabbi Soloveitchik say? Well, not everybody knows what he would say. And different people saw different sides of him. And some people saw the philosophical, and some people saw the drashot, and some people saw that he allowed a co-ed education, and some people saw which sides of him they wanted to. He was a complex man. He was a man with many sides to him. But in his heart and his soul, he was a man who was involved in the world of Torah. That's who he was. And he actually felt the Jewish philosophy, he wrote this in a book called Halachic Mind, he felt that authentic Jewish philosophy is what emerges when you study halacha. Now that we've studied a little bit of the laws of Pikuach Nefesh, that's what Jewish philosophy is. There's conflicting values. Shabbat is a value. Saving a life is a value. But because Shabbat is a value is why saving a life is such an important value. As we go through this situation that we're in right now, and whenever a question comes up, ask yourself, what would Rabbi Soloveitchik say? And he would say, be very, very machmir and very, very careful in terms of pikuach nefesh. Make sure that we're keeping ourselves and other people safe. On the other hand, it's a world of action, it's a world of reality, and it's not just a theoretical world, and it needs to spill over to the way that we live our lives as well, not just in terms of theoretical constructs. Hopefully, the Torah that we learned together today should be le'iloi nishmato. And do yourselves a favor. I know that some of his philosophical books are more difficult, harder to read, to understand. There are other books which are really quite approachable. Especially, there's a book which is called, in English, The Rav Speaks, which was the talks that he gave to the Mizrahi. So if any of us need a reminder of what Zionism was or should be, so this is something which is worthwhile reading. It was a work that he gave when he left the Aguda, and he was the vice president of the Aguda. He's the one who gave the hesped for Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski when he passed away. And he left, and he was asked by all the rabbis of the Aguda to do it. And when he left the Aguda and he joined the Mizrahi, he, in a sense, gave his speeches as far as what he believes in. And this is really quite worthwhile reading. All these are talks from the 50s, and they're worthwhile reading today. So I thank Rabbi Krebs for inviting me. And Bezrat Hashem, we'll have an opportunity to meet again.
Thank you so much, Rabbi. It's been an absolute pleasure hearing from you. You should stay safe, and we'll be in the simcha. It should all go well. Rabbi Khan, thank you so much. Hope you have a good day and have a good evening.
Thank you.
God's